everyone. Thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Amanda Vinicky. What's the price for spending decades behind bars for a murder you didn't commit?
In the amount of $50 million.
That's Chicago's price tag, believed to be the city's largest ever payout for police misconduct. The city owes it to four men exonerated for murder convictions based on coerced confessions.
The families whose 60 days expire, they can come back if there are beds. 55% of them do. About 45% of them move on. So yes, we are still living up to our values.
The reprieve is over for migrants with students. With school out, shelter evictions begin. A criminal investigation hits Cook County Health over a massive data breach.
There were big holes in the ceilings of the buildings, and we could see raccoons as they peer from the holes.
The governor should cherish and hold on to that investment by rebuilding here in Logan County.
Sentiments heated over plans to demolish two state prisons.
Since this is really a concept and not a plan.
But lawmakers ask, what plan? And in a decision that's caused a lot of noise, Riot Fest packs up and moves to Bridgeview. And joining us to talk about all that and more is our Week in Review panel. That's Samantha Smiley from Chalkbeat Chicago, freelance reporter Lee John Greco, Dan Mihalopoulos from WBEZ, and Jennifer Fuller from Capital News Illinois. Now, let's get right to it. City Council voting unanimously on Wednesday to pay $50 million, Lee, to four men. They spent 20 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit. $50 million sounds like a lot, but is that enough?
Yeah, I don't think it's enough given these four men spent the majority of their young lives in prison for a crime they didn't commit. And, you know, when you think about it, this is really just the tip of the iceberg that we're seeing in terms of these police settlements.
Tell us about this case.
Yeah, so the detectives that coerced these false confessions out of these young men, they were trained by John Burge, the disgraced former commander. And so now city taxpayers owe $21 million for these settlements. The city's insurance owes another $29 million for this. And as I mentioned, you know, your own colleague, Heather Sharon, she had an assessment of some of these lawsuits that CPD had to settle stemming from the 2020 protests, and those cost taxpayers $5.6 million. So it's very concerning both from, you know, the point of view of how these officers are conducting themselves, but also, you know, the actual cost to everyday Chicagoans.
Yeah, Dan, is this a cost that Chicago can continue to afford?
That's an excellent question, but it has been paying out. There's some of it is covered by insurance, but you would assume that, like anybody else, if you have to go to your insurance company often, that might affect your premiums as well. These are enormous costs in the hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. It continues to happen. It's both a moral disgrace and a financial issue. We had last year, almost a year ago exactly, on the first Juneteenth of Brandon Johnson's administration as mayor of Chicago, I was covering the opening of the memorial on the south side for the survivors of John Burge's torture, who are legion. And when you look at an event like that, the human cost far outnumbers the money, but the money is staggering.
It's so much that we're all paying. And to be clear, of course, this was they spent two decades behind bars. They were exonerated some years ago, I believe in 2017. They were teens at the time. So that's an old case. But Samantha, the city of Chicago, of course, is still under a consent decree, only 7% compliant. Of course, consent decrees do take time. But why are we seeing so little progress? And what does this payout sort of bring to the fore in terms of police relations now?
I'm an education reporter, but in general, I think I just think it's really disturbing that people spend 20 years of their lives
20 years
in jail. There's a lot of stuff that happens between your teenage years to your 40s, and losing that is just really heartbreaking. I mean, like, I know we're talking about the money, but like, these people lost their lives. There's a lot of things that happen in jail that is traumatic for those folks. They also sometimes they feel like they cannot go back into their communities and relate to people. And who knows if they're able to get like a job to sustain themselves. Like, That just, to me is really upsetting, and I don't think
that's why we decided to lead the show with it. I think that there's, I mean, it continues to play out, and there is just such a human toll. Now, Dan, I want to go to you because in sticking with the topic of police, but a new story out from you today, and this is about the extremist groups that are on a list that Chicago police officers are barred from joining. Now, what groups make the cut and which don't?
Well, they have put in some rules that say that if you associate with criminal or biased organizations, there were restrictions for decades on being in a criminal organization, but they expanded it to say criminal or biased organizations. And the police department was entrusted under that rule to come up with a list, identify groups that are biased organizations. So we did a Freedom of Information Act request together with Tom Shuba at the Sun-Times. We've done these stories on looking into the records of these officers who join extremist groups and the effect that they've had on people in the community that they serve and protect ostensibly. And we found that on that list were 675 groups, all of which are street gangs, not a single biased group, not the Oath Keepers, not the Proud Boys, not the Ku Klux Klan, all of which have counted Chicago police officers among their members at one time or another.
So despite biased organizations, the definition expanding, there are not any that fit under that category.
CPD hasn't put any of them on the list, and we asked them about that, and the CPD spokesperson told us, you know, we're going to identify them on a case-by-case basis, and going forward, we're going to, you know.
So why have a policy?
Exactly.
Okay, and just to be clear, the Community Commission for Police Safety and Accountability put out a statement saying that there was some misinterpretation, though?
Yeah, I mean, we stand by our story completely. You know, this is a story where they're saying that they still can use this rule to take out somebody from the force, which they haven't been able to do, by the way. Almost all of them have not even been punished. And so, you know, I'd let them speak for themselves about why they went after us. But the Inspector General of the City of Chicago told us that she feels that the lack of those groups on that list undermines the goal that they stated, which was, and the mayor has promised to rid the department of Proud Boys and Oath Keepers specifically. He said that as a campaign promise. So we totally stand by our story.
All right, now let's move on to another major Chicago agency. And here is where our education reporter is going to come into play. Chicago Public Schools was supposed to release its budget for the 2025 fiscal year this week, but now that's been delayed. What's the issue? Why don't we have a proposal?
I know. I think everybody's looking for it because it's supposed to. So what we know so far is that the Chicago Board of Education said that they were going to move away from student-based enrollment, how they fund schools, to more of an opportunity, like checking to make sure that there's enough teachers for students and things like that, right? And we already know that there were some LSCs who were pretty upset about, sorry, some local school councils that were very upset about that. And even some of them had completely, like, was like, no, we're not. We can't take this budget because we can't, because we're losing our teacher positions here. And so it's just going to be interesting to see what's happening, especially because we have a nearly, the school district, not me, but has a $400 million deficit, nearly. Their COVID-19 funds will expire September 30th, and we just got the state budget, and there's no additional dollars more than what, like, for what CPS has asked for when they went down to Springfield.
So basically, perhaps the delay might be because it's not finished. They're having a hard time bridging the gap. We don't know, but
yeah,
that's a possibility?
That could be a possibility.
And Jen, over to you. As Samantha noted, that state, what, is there any chance, the budget just passed, CPS needs this money, they say, any chance the state's going to come through with some sort of rescue?
You know, we see this every year where some group or another comes to Springfield and says, oh, wait, we have this huge emergency and we really need this funding. And the lawmakers sit and listen and then they go home and that need is still on the table. Could it happen? Sure, anything's possible. Is it likely? Probably not. This was a difficult budget year. We saw this as we saw the negotiations play out, and we saw it in that all night long debate when the House tried to pass the budget and needed three chances to get it across the finish line. So bringing in another appropriation at this point, I don't think is very likely.
No, Samantha, this is happening as CPS and the CTU are holding their first ever, literally like as we're taping the show, the first ever public negotiating session is going on. Is this really going to be public?
Yes, there's going to be public.
How does that work?
So I guess they're going to sit around the table and go over the union's proposal and go over what management has to say about it and their reason for it. I mean, I'm a union girly myself, so I know these how negotiations go. So that's what I think is going to happen. I don't know actually if the public is going to be able to say anything or give any feedback.
New.
But yeah, it's completely new. It's interesting.
Lee, what do you think?
Yeah, and the first, so it's my understanding that the public negotiation is just going to focus on green schools. So it's kind of more about HVAC systems, lead pipes, that sort of thing. I don't get the sense that we are going to get to kind of the juicy things that a lot of folks might be interested in.
The things they've struck over recently.
Yes, exactly. So I was curious a couple weeks ago, and I was asking about these public negotiations. Well, what are we going to hear? And I'm going to be honest.
So what is the point of this? Is it to... What, Dan?
I don't want to be jaded, but you know, you have a mayor that still controls the schools, although they fought for and they're going to get this hybrid model where some of them are elected. You still have effectively mayoral control, which has been the case for, what, close to 30 years now. And now for the first time in that period, you have a mayor who comes from that union, and you know, the city schools are the biggest part of your property tax bill. It's not as big a budget, I don't think, as maybe City Hall, but it's an enormous, it's the largest sister agency by far. So the idea that the labor force, which, and personnel costs are the largest cost within that, the idea that you know, they're not gonna help elect a mayor so that they can get a good contract, I think, you know, they're trying to fight that impression, maybe with some theater, perhaps, or with some more tension than there might be there inherently. But who knows? Maybe he'll negotiate with them very, very aggressively on behalf of the taxpayers.
But then you see the mayor intervening directly in, you know, issues in Springfield, like, for example, you know, Margaret Croak's bill on selective enrollment, which, you know, he kind of put his thumb on the scales there by giving a call to Senate President Don Harmon. So, yeah, it's this weird dance where, you know, he says,
perhaps trying to look hands off, but getting intimately involved at the same time. Is that fair, Samantha?
Yeah, I believe that's fair. Yeah.
And, you know, we hear a lot in Chicago, of course, about CPS and this budget shortfall of $400 million that CPS is facing. But, Jen, can you put this into perspective for us? Because there are downstate schools where maybe it's not the same dollar amount.
Yeah, not by a lot. But
is the pain commensurate?
Oh, sure. I think you see some of the same problems all over. In fact, you know, Samantha and I were talking even before we got started about deferred maintenance at some of these schools, average age of some of the facilities that these students are learning in, and there are some of the same problems across the state.
So class
you're
sizes,
seeing, oh, sure,
lack of
technology, buildings that can't house the number of students that are within the walls, for example. And you see some things happening in some areas that maybe aren't as palatable in other areas. Where I live in far southern Illinois, the county went to taxpayers and said, hey, can we pass a 1% sales tax that'll fund school facilities? Mm-hmm. And the taxpayers said yes. Some counties are doing the same thing, and they're not able to get that. Mm-hmm. So there's this back and forth. We understand we need to support the kids. We understand we need the support for education. But how much is too much? And that question is going on for sure all over the state. And the state is having the same issue about how to get that funding to the schools. We saw this conversation when evidence-based funding was put in place. And now they're trying to figure out, okay, on top of evidence-based funding, how do we continue to get those schools that need the extra help, that help that they need?
And Samantha, just briefly here, CPS also out this week on data on student performance. So we are seeing that there are gains, but still, where is proficiency at?
Yeah, so more students are proficient in reading or English language arts, and they're even outperform. There's more students who are proficient than they were in 2019 before the pandemic, which is really good sign.
That's huge.
And you're seeing like Black and Latino students making really big gains in that way in terms of how many students are proficient, but there's still a lot of students are still lagging in math. And they only increased about 2 percentage points compared to last year, and they haven't even reached the pre-pandemic proficiency rate. So
there's still a lot to go there. Part of negotiations, I'm sure.
I believe so. I think that might come up in terms of like the teacher-student ratio, in terms of what can be used in the classroom. But also, there's this is about the state standardized test known as the Illinois Assessment of Readiness. A lot of school districts actually don't like it because the results come out so late and students have already gone to the next class. So a lot of schools actually use an assessment that they have bought, and they kind of test students 2 or 3 times a year to kind of figure out where they're at already.
Maybe more useful there. And I believe also, by the way, just those numbers, 30% of elementary students from CPS rated as proficient in reading, less than 20 in math. Now, Dan, going to turn to you. You had another story, big week for you, reporting that federal authorities investigating a massive data breach at Cook County Health. Now, unfortunately, hacks of healthcare systems are no longer rare. So why does this one prompt a criminal investigation?
Well, for one thing, I can't speak for the prosecutors, but it is the biggest one in the country. I think there are a total of 14 million people, at least, across the country that have been affected in places like New York State and other parts of the country as well.
Cook County Health's breach?
Well, no, the breach involved
a private entity.
Exactly. Let's be clear. Cook County Health wasn't breached. A private entity that had patient information and very sensitive personal information, including like diagnostic exams and other personal information that you would give to any doctor, that company was breached. And they found that out last year. They told Cook County Health, and finally late last year, Cook County Health sent letters to these 1.2 million patients whose data may have been affected by the breach. It's hard to imagine something bigger than that, because Cook County Health, it's an enormous hospital system with a goal of helping really people that can't go anywhere else, right, that are probably uninsured. And there are a lot of people like that in Chicago and in Cook County. So when you look at this breach, it's a big deal, but we don't know exactly where the feds are going with it. We got a copy of the subpoena. We had to sue. Cook County Health didn't want to give it to us, and our lawyer, Matt Topic, on behalf of WBZ, sued. They relented. They gave this to us, and it showed that they wanted a lot of things, the contract, how they vetted the company, and any communications that they had about the breach. We don't know of any charges yet, though.
And if
stemming
it's
from that,
the investigation really at Cook County Health or the private entity.
Well, they sent it to Cook County Health, but the breach was definitely at the private entity with Cook County patients' information.
And it took a long time for these patients to be notified, right?
Yeah, there are lawsuits where they that have been filed against Cook County Health and against the contractor who's from Nevada, saying that, hey, you know, you should have told us sooner. Because I think it happened earlier last year. It was discovered sometime, around July. Don't hold me to the timeline, but it wasn't until November that you...
Some months went by. Lee, what does that say to you in terms of... That's people's personal information, social security numbers perhaps, health information.
Well, like you mentioned when you opened this up, Cook County is not the only hospital or hospital system to get hit by this. We had the Lurie's breach a couple months ago, and that was, you know, just kind of wrapping up recently. And I think what it shows is that a lot of these hospital systems are very far behind when it comes to their data security, basically, and they're rapidly trying to play catch up, and it's essentially, you know, it's too late. They're just far behind the eight ball. But it also, you know, you mentioned that you had to sue for these records as well, and you know, I really feel for Matt Topic right now, because between Cook County and the city, he's got his hands full.
Staying busy. Just give us the information. It's public. Okay, there's my PSA. Now, Jennifer, your colleagues have done some really superb reporting on homeschooling in the state, and what they found is not a pretty picture. Can you just give us a brief synopsis?
Sure. So this was our partnership with ProPublica. Our reporters Beth Hunsdorfer and Molly Parker spent months looking at the number of students whose parents, for whatever reason, have pulled them out of public school and said, we're homeschooling our children. For a large majority of people, or I shouldn't say majority, a large number of people, they are homeschooling. They're finding online curricula, they're doing maybe a faith-based program, something like that. But there is a segment of that population that are called no schoolers. Mm-hmm. And these children are slipping through the cracks. As we all know, there are mandated reporters that you find in every school, whether it's a teacher, a school counselor, a coach, that can recognize things like abuse, like neglect, malnourishment, those sorts of things. And if those children aren't able to see those people on a daily basis, they're falling through those safety cracks. Mm-hmm. And we found stories, heartbreaking stories, of children who were begging for food from their neighbors, going to a local convenience store and begging for quarters so that they could go in and buy some food, and then they would go home and get in trouble.
The state has no regulation. Has this prompted any calls for that?
You know, we hear that every year, but the homeschool organization has a very, very strong lobby, and they go to Springfield every year. They thank lawmakers for the fact that there are not a lot of regulations on homeschooling in Illinois. And so there's this constant battle about what to do and what not to do, because the state can keep track of a student up and until they are no longer truant. Once the family says, we are homeschooling, they can't do anything anymore. We have stories of truancy officers who are literally on the steps of the courthouse going to court to try and get these parents to get the students back in school. And the parents say, homeschool, and they walk away.
Give that a read. Now, speaking of vulnerable children, Mayor Johnson's administration this week began this process of forcibly removing migrant families from city shelters under that 60-day eviction policy. Lee, what options do these migrants have?
Well, this is really tough right now because, as the story noted, school was really one of the only forms of stability for these kids right now. You know, they're living in the shelters and then they go to a CPS school. And now, of course, school is out, and so they don't have that anymore. And what is really confusing is that something like 55%, I think, of these families who are told that they have to leave these shelters, they then have to go back to this bus station, which is essentially this limbo where they wait. And then around half of them who go there end up back in the shelters.
So what's the point? If they're going to get out of a shelter and then back in, Samantha, is there something that I'm missing in terms of why that makes practical sense?
No, I don't think any of it makes sense. And it feels very inhumane at this time, especially when, for children experiencing homelessness, the summer has always been a very hard thing for them to figure out food, to figure out where to go. It's also super hot in Chicago. Like, next week is going to be 90, so I will be in New Orleans, so I'm sorry to y'all. But like,
hotter there, I think.
Yeah, it is. That's true.
But also, it's going to be hot. Most of these migrants, excuse me, are from Venezuela. I thought it was one of the hardest things I had to see was people with, like, jean jackets in the middle of the winter here. Mm-hmm. I was actually thinking this is more like the weather in Venezuela the last few days, but 43,000 have been brought here from the border since Texas, I think, was the first to start bringing the buses here. Past some selling candy and water bottles, far from downtown, by the way, way out on the northwest side on the way here today. And $150 million for the city, which, again, like what we were talking about, the police misconduct settlements, big sum for the city. And they could be going, you know, somewhere else. So I think it's a very tough situation right now.
And no good answers.
And the second time that they've said that they're going to evict people, there were some exceptions that were made and extensions that were given the last time this happened in March. But they seem to be thinking, well, school's out now, let's disrupt them better in the summer than during the school year.
That's still just hard. I mean, like, the problem is in our city, in the state, throughout the country, is that we don't have affordable housing. That's the big problem that
it's
we need.
Exacerbated right. On the homelessness issues that already existed in Chicago.
Yeah, and so the question has been for years is, when are we going to get affordable housing for people? When is the city going to buy a property in order to develop these homes? And this, like, you know, but I don't
still know answers.
Yeah, we still don't have any answers.
We've got about 30 seconds left. So, Jennifer, I want to turn to you on prison closures. There were a couple of hearings about the proposed closures that Pritzker wants to make for prisons in Joliet, Logan, and then rebuild prisons. Mm-hmm. We had some action from the state today. Real quick, what was that action?
I'm not sure I would call it action, Amanda. There was no vote, a lack of a quorum from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, which really was holding only an advisory vote to let the governor's office know how everyone feels. These two hearings hearings brought out a lot of emotions from people saying
a lot of emotions.
You're going to cut jobs, you're going to destroy economies. It remains to be seen exactly how this is going to play out.
All right. Well, we will be watching what the Pritzker administration does with that. I think he seems pretty dedicated to moving forward with his plan, but we'll see. We are out of time. Our thanks to Samantha Smiley, Lee John Greco, Jennifer Fuller, and Dan Mielopoulos. We're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family. The Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that is our show for this Friday night. Don't forget, you can get Chicago Tonight and The Week in Review streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. Now for The Week in Review, I'm Amanda Vinicky. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Enjoy this gorgeous weather and have a great night. I want to talk about Riot Fest before we are gone. Dan, it's moving from the city. Is this a loss for the city or a gain for the neighborhood?
Is it a gain for Bridgeview? I mean, it seems like everywhere they go, people don't like them. I mean, maybe people, I don't know anything about the music at my age, but, you know,
Beyonce. B52s, come on.
Are they there?
They do know them. A couple years ago, they were great.
I think maybe it's very popular long, far beyond where it's located, but wherever it's located, there were huge problems at Douglas Park and in the previous location, I think, at Humboldt Park, and now Bridgeview. The Red Stars, I feel for those young women. They're
closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.